You had a good weekend, seeing we're on here on Friday night.
Yeah, no, I had a lovely weekend. Thank you very much. It's been really good. We've had some good feedback from our last show, which was on dementia.
Yes.
On Friday night. And that is now podcast up on Spreaker. But if you'd like to access that one and listen into what we got up to last Friday night, just jump on our Facebook page, which is Facebook Bay FM. Searchlight Bay FM. Searchlight Bay FM on Facebook, and you can like us there. And what we're going to invite you to do tonight, folks, is join us and send in your questions through our Facebook page. If you have Facebook, as we said, Searchlight Bay FM. And you will be able to talk to us. Adele has that in front of her and she's checking it all the time. And later on, once we've finished talking to our guests, if you'd like to talk to us, give us a call during a song and we will be more than happy to talk to you and engage and answer any questions you may have. If you just call 3821-0022. That's 3821-0022. Now, we have some very important guests tonight, Adele. Who have we got?
We've got some great guests lined up, Craig. So we have Christine Smythe, the current president of the Queensland Law Society. She's our first guest, so she'll be up really soon. Our second guest is Dr. Joan Lawrence. She's a doctor of psychiatry. She's a past president of the AMA Queensland. She's past president of the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatrists. What's interesting for this show and the topic we have for this show, which is around whether people are responsible for their crimes and when they are not due to mental illness. So she spent 12 years assisting as the assisting psychiatrist in the mental health court. So she's got a wealth of knowledge to share with us. And our third guest is Joe Briggs. He's a lawyer with Legal Aid. He's been a lawyer since 1990. And he's got lots of things to talk to us about as well from the Legal Aid perspective when it comes to people who are unfit to stand trial. And I know probably throughout this evening we will be corrected on our wording. Sure. We're not lawyers, so we'll need some help from our guests to make sure that we're sharing things with the right terminology. But tonight's about raising awareness and education and understanding better how the system works for these particular people.
All right, and our very first guest I've already got hanging on the line right now. Christine, how are you?
Oh, good evening. I'm well, thank you. I hope everyone else is well.
Yeah, no, we're doing really well here. Thank you very much, and thank you for joining us tonight. Christine, first question. The Queensland Law Society, what role does it play in issues around accused people who may be suffering a mental illness? What role does QLS have?
Okay. Queensland Law Society is the peak professional body for lawyers in Queensland. We have some 12,000 members who are solicitors throughout our vast and beautiful state. We are a membership organisation and we have a variety of objectives. First of all, we represent the interests of solicitors throughout the state, and in doing that, we advocate for good law and good lawyers. We have an advocacy arm where we review legislative developments and make recommendations as to those legislative developments and any unintended consequences. I like to tell people that effectively the Queensland Law Society is almost like having a Queensland upper house. We're there to check and be a check and balances on the development of law in the state. We also have a disciplinary aspect in terms of practicing solicitors, so that's one aspect that we have. And other aspects is educating the community and engaging with the community, because ultimately what we do as solicitors is we like to help people. We're helpers. Mm. And I noticed that you mentioned before about possibly getting some of the language wrong and getting the lawyers to help out. Part of our role is to try and demystify and simplify that complex legal process, because it is complex, and to try and have the community understand it from a perspective that they can see, as opposed to that complex legal you know, the gobbledygooks, for want of a better phrase.
That's something lawyers are famous for.
We are. We do lots of sexy language in complicated ways. Yes, you know, ask a solicitor what colour is on the wall and they'll tell you it depends.
So, how do you get out and educate, advocate and ensure? I really enjoyed when we had a brief conversation this afternoon, you talking about the good law and yes, making sure that that it continues to be that way. What are the mechanisms you have to ensure that that actually takes place with good law and good lawyers?
One of the mechanisms is what we're doing this evening, chatting to you folk and reaching out to the community. That's what we do quite regularly. We do a lot of communication with government and appear at government hearings, parliamentary hearings. We review the legislation. We take on board commentary from our members. As I mentioned, we have 12,000 solicitors practising in the state, and those solicitors come in contact with members of the community each and every day. So we're facing at the coalface of problems that people are presented with, the complexities and difficulties of navigating the legal system. And our role is to take up the recommendations from our members and cast an eye over these developments to make sure that these unintended consequences don't come through the legislation or are as minimised as much as possible, so that we've got good law for all of the state. Good law is about thinking about how it will work in all of the circumstances and road testing. Really, we're about road testing that law and ensuring that it's not an emotive reaction as opposed to a thought out process. And often we can be quite swayed by the emotive consequences of someone's actions and have strong feelings and strong emotions that come with that. But once those emotions and feelings settle down, it's really about adding a layer of cool-headedness and thoughtfulness to how a proposed change might impact on a different set of circumstances and not necessarily the one that's causing the difficulty that we get faced with. And that was the difficulty with the fire day matter up in North Queensland. It was a particularly emotive decision. Mm. All of us who are parents could not possibly fathom what it would be to kill your own children, let alone that many children. And so we as a society sit back and ask ourselves, how could this possibly have happened? Mm. Should there be punishments that are applied? And these are all the questions that would naturally come from such a terrible and really quite gut-wrenching incident.
Well, I've got a few questions, not sure, about that case, but there's been, in my research for tonight's show, I came across a statement from, I think it was an appeal court decision, where the judges in that case said that there seems to be a grave anomaly in our current laws, in that mm-hmm. if you're up for a serious crime such as murder, grievous bodily harm and so on, you do have the ability to seek or to have sought for you the pathway of the mental health court, mm-hmm. and then have you declared to be, I don't know what the proper terminology is, it incompetent mm-hmm. to stand trial, or is it mm-hmm. Whatever it may be. But if mm-hmm. it's a summary matter, so for example a simple assault or something mm-hmm. that can be dealt with in the magistrate's court, they were saying that avenue is not available, and mm. many magistrates are not, well, I'm sorry, I will retract that. There are some magistrates that have been quoted, that they mm-hmm. quoted, that were not prepared to listen mm-hmm. to advocacy from the duty lawyer, for example, mm-hmm. and insisted the matter be dealt with, which inevitably found that person guilty.
Mm-hmm. If there's a deficiency in the law, then it's Parliament's responsibility to listen to the cries of the public.
But, so but Parliament when, is... When the court says that that appears to be a significant deficiency in the law, does the Queensland Law Society then say, you know what, we sort of agree with you there, and that's when you go to the Parliament and say, guys, we think this is a shortcoming, maybe you need to look at it? Or is that something that you just have to sit back and wait for the public to say, no, we're not putting up with this, we want change?
Sure. By and large, the Queensland Law Society is not about developing policy for the legislature. The legislatures are the one that are voted into Parliament, and they're voted into Parliament by the people in our community to make those policy decisions. That's by and large. And so what will happen is the legislature, we live in a democratic society where our community says this is the government that we trust to make laws around these issues. Now, and so often that's how we will be responsive to the development of those laws. If, however, there is a significant outcry either from the legal fraternity or the community around a deficiency in the law, we will often turn our mind to that if it's brought to us specifically, and look at that and lobby for changes if we think that the criticisms are warranted. So it's a bit of a two-way street, but by and large what we as the Law Society do is we respect our democratic process and the right of the Parliament of the to make policy decisions about what the laws are from time to time.
I guess my direction, and I'm not trying to trick anyone up or anything. The reason I'm asking is because in those summary matters, it's going to be the in a large proportion of cases, people from below the poverty line, homeless folks who suffer the greatest proportion of mental illness, and are caught in these situations where they're often up before the beak, as they say, the magistrate, and it's a revolving door sometimes, and many of them may well end up in the prison system. And an appeal court judge or judges have said, well, this appears to be a significant shortcoming that may lead to injustice. Given that group is not exactly highly sought after for votes, it's not going to be high on the agenda for our political masters to say, well, maybe we need to do something about this. Seeing as how the QLS has a strong focus on ensuring that everybody's
social justice.
Is that something that says, okay, now we need to maybe have a look at this, or do your rules say you can't?
No, absolutely not. No, certainly. If it's something that is of significance, and this is the first time this issue has been raised with me directly. So certainly it's something that after tonight's discussion I'll be taking to my people and inquiring as to the breadth and extent of this particular issue. But certainly if these issues are brought to our attention and we're being asked to look at it, we'll certainly do that. Now, you're quite right. Social justice is about ensuring that those who are the most impoverished and underprivileged in our society are not thrust at the revolving door of justice. And the Queensland Law Society has been, in the last year and a half to 2 years, been doing a lot of work in that community legal centre space and ensuring that those who wouldn't otherwise have access to proper legal advice could get that. And that's what a lot of our advocacy has been over the last 2 years with respect to the fiscal cliff and the federal government's threat to reduce funding to a lot of community legal centres. And certainly that is definitely an issue that needs ongoing advocacy. And there are many organisations that do have an interest in that arena. And there are, as you say, some of your speakers are coming on later on tonight, Legal Aid, for example, and then there are other community organisations that do a lot of work in that space.
So you're saying that federally the funding isn't consistent?
That's correct.
And so I guess that makes it really hard as a sort of an over umbrella body to be able to tap in where you need to tap in to different resources and people who are dealing with those who are impoverished and in the lower socioeconomic area of society. I'm really interested in how you look at advocating for people, or not individuals, or generally speaking, who are caught up in the mental health court, that they're unable to speak for themselves clearly, and they've got there's evidence that they committed the crime when they were unable to be at full cognition. How do you look at ensuring that their vulnerability is not exploited? And again, that's probably not the best word to use, but I'm just looking at the advocacy and the ensuring, as you mentioned earlier about the North Queensland case, you know, a case which is, you know, as you mentioned, quite horrific, but at the soul of that is still a person. And what involvement do you have, along with your looking at good law and good lawyers? I guess that's one part of it. Mm-hmm. What else do you, as an organisation, do to support in that instance, or is that not within your scope of what you do?
No, it's definitely within the scope of what we do. One of my favourite quotes is, I think it's from Gandhi, which says, the measure of a society is how it treats its most vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And certainly, yes, in those circumstances, we've got vulnerabilities everywhere. We've got children who are vulnerable, and we've got a mentally affected person who's vulnerable as well. Now, in terms of what the Queensland Law Society and its members do, this is not commonly known because it's not fashionable to champion what lawyers do. Mm. But in 2016, Well, in 2016, our last measure, Queensland solicitors did no less than 290,000 hours of pro bono work. There is no other profession or organisation that provides that level of free services to the community. Our members are absolutely passionate about giving back to the community. There is no legislative requirement for us to do so. There's no legal requirement for us to do so. We simply do it because the vast bulk of solicitors in this state are people who want to help other people. Now, that is what we do as part of our practice. Now, what the Queensland Law Society does is assist our members in being able to do that. In the Friday matter, and in most matters when we're talking about this issue of lack of competency to stand for trial, what we really need to understand is that when making decisions about whether or not someone is fit for trial, the court must consider whether that person is fit to instruct their legal advisers. And generally, what they do is they go through a very, very complex process. It involves at least 2 to 3 independent psychiatric assessments that are completed before a decision is made. And when making the decision about whether or not a person is fit to stand for trial, the court considers whether or not they consider the following factors. And this comes in back to the magistrate's aspect and the difference between a summary matter and an indictable offence. They consider the seriousness of the crime, the severity of the mental illness, the need to protect society, and the need to protect the defendants from themselves. That is a balancing process. It's a slow process, it's rigorous, and it's undertaken with the utmost of care. Now, the number of murders in Queensland are not very high as it is. We're too busy sunbaking on the beach, I think, being nice to each other. But having said that, those where an individual has been ruled criminally insane are even fewer. For the Friday matter, I believe the most recent matter was the matter of Mr. Gabriel, and that was about 10 years ago.
Wow, so it's really uncommon.
It's uncommon, yes. It's uncommon because it's a very strict test. Now, there are two aspects to that. It's a question of, are you so psychiatrically damaged that you need to be dealt with in our mental health system, or are you reasonably competent and you need to be dealt with through our criminal justice system? And that's a fine balance. And like all things, it's not going to be right every time. And I suspect the issue that you're trying to address here is that there are lots of people in our prison systems who suffer from mental illness. Mm. And the question is the degree of that mental illness and what help are they getting? And most certainly the Queensland Law Society's position on this is that we need a lot more funding and focus on diversionary programs than we do on punitive programs.
We also need a lot more funding for the legal aid services themselves, mm-hmm. because for all of the pro bono work that's done by solicitors around Queensland and indeed across Australia, and yeah. you know, it is extraordinary the amount of free work they do. There's also a lot of the stuff that goes on behind that mm. that can't be free, such as if they need to get psychiatric reports, if they need to get specialists yes. or expert witnesses, they all cost,
yes.
and they're not willing.
That's exactly right.
They don't do yeah. their work for free. Now, if they go through legal aid, that's covered, isn't it? To an extent.
Unfortunately, to a certain extent, if you go through legal aid, but unfortunately, the funding to legal aid, notwithstanding that it has been increasing, it's just not enough.
No, it's ridiculously low.
It's simply not enough. I do not understand this mentality that we as a nation consider healthcare to be so necessary that the government is prepared to fund Medicare, but we don't have any equivalent of what I would call legal care. Mm. Everybody in this state, we operate on the rule of law. The society is about order. And if you want disorder and chaos, let me quote Shakespeare. The first thing you must do is kill all the lawyers.
Mm. Yes.
Actually, I always just read that completely on its own. First, we kill all the lawyers. No.
Well, that's Craig.
That's the whole point of that quote. It's amplifying the fact that if you do not have people who are there yeah. ready, willing and able to advocate without fear or favour for the rights of those in society, you will have chaos. In order for society to function properly and well and effectively, you need to have people who can translate and navigate and assist the everyday person through a complex legal system. And it's complex for a reason. People are complex. Human beings are not easy creatures. Mm. And the law requires a balancing of everyone's needs. And sometimes it's going to hit the mark, sometimes it's going to miss the mark. But the truth of it is that every day, in every way, we are all engaging in some kind of legal transaction or something that has a legal impact on us. And you're quite right when you mentioned about that revolving door of justice. Often that slippery slope into descent of disarray and into the criminal justice system is because someone doesn't know a very basic and simple right at the very outset.
And
how to apply for a waiver of a fine that they can't afford, or how to get advice about housing and accommodation so that they're not on the street. These are legal rights, and we as a good, just and prosperous society should have some basic level of entitlement to access legal advice. Mm-hmm. Government shouldn't be diverting its responsibilities onto the good nature of solicitors and expecting them to pick up their slack.
So, Christine, sorry.
Yeah. That's all right.
I'm interrupting.
Getting on a roll.
No, and I don't want to stop you because it's fascinating to listen to. Is this any different in other countries?
There are other countries that provide greater amounts of legal aid and legal assistance. The question is what we as a nation want, not what is everyone else doing, but mm-hmm. what we as a nation want.
And certainly it's not raised out there in the public, is it? I certainly don't remember the last time there was any form of discourse in the community about legal rights, as you're talking about, in just the right to access legal support.
Yes, and I think it's time that we started having that conversation.
The areas that you're that people may be entitled to get free legal advice are also
very limited.
Yeah, very. I was going to say severely limited. For example, in the area I work in, I'm not a lawyer, but the area I work in, industrial relations. There's no grounds, no ability to get free legal advice on that. But the other issue is, in context of the program tonight, people with mental illness, people with intellectual disabilities, people who indeed may not understand the rights and wrongs of a system and anything else, they particularly have no knowledge and virtually no chance of getting in touch with these, because if Adele, I'm talking to you here, if you ever want to see chaos in action, go down to Beenleigh Magistrates Court on a Monday morning. It is nuts. Mm. And the duty lawyer down there, I have never seen anybody so frazzled in my entire life. The pile of files reaching from waist to chin. If a client got more than 3 minutes, I'd be stunned.
Mm. And you know what this does? It creates mental health issues in the legal profession.
Yeah.
Ah, yes.
We have vicarious trauma as a result of being so swamped by being confronted by so many people with such high-level needs. The legal profession is wonderful insofar as we give a lot. We're also affected. We have to put on a professional persona. We have to be seen to and behave and give advice that is objective and independent. We are what makes solicitors different to any other profession is that we are officers of the court first. We have a duty to uphold the law first before advocating for the rights of our clients second. And that is something that's quite critical to understand. So when a client presents a problem to us, we must respond to that problem as an officer of the court and deal with it in a very strictly legal sense. And often that means having to pare away all of those human aspects of the mental illness and the poverty and the other issues that bring about a legal problem. This is not a single solution here. This is a collective solution. It's a holistic solution. Because often when people present with legal problems, they're born of other issues, and you quite rightly point out mental health issues, poverty, disability, they are all factors that will lead to an avalanche of legal problems if they are not dealt with properly and comprehensively.
Can I ask now a very specific question? We won't keep you on the line for too much longer. I know you've got to go. But from what I've been able to see under the Act, this is the Mental Health Act and others, if you are suffering a mental defect that is natural in nature or acquired, as in a brain injury, then you fit within the definitions, and therefore you can seek protection under the Mental Health Act and Mental Health Court. However, if you are overdose on a certain sort of drug, and you have taken that drug deliberately yourself.
A recreational drug or some other drug, you
don't have those protections. But if you dosed with that drug unknowingly, you are. Is there a particular reason, if you overdose on a drug and you're unaware, is there a particular reason that you taking that drug yourself means that the fact that you may be incoherent, irrational, unable to tell what you're doing is still irrelevant in that particular case?
It's relevant. What the test is do you have an underlying psychiatric illness that so significantly affects your cognition in the first instance?
Mm.
And so that's the distinguishing feature, is the extent of your underlying psychiatric illness. Now, and I think the point that you're driving at here is that some people have low-level psychiatric illnesses that they can self-medicate for, and that self-medicating results in this kind of erratic and often difficult and criminal behaviour. Mm. And that is a policy question.
Right.
It's the one for society to ask itself. Mm. Is society prepared to allow this defence for those people who have sufficient cognition on a day-to-day basis to understand what it is that, you know, in a unmedicated, that it would be alcohol or drugged state, would you understand doing that kind of act is a wrong thing? And we as a society say that if we are in that state and we understand that it would be wrong, and then we take drugs and then we do that act, then we say that you had a degree of control. It's a question of how much control over your mental state that you have. And that's a question for society. It's certainly not a question for me, but it's certainly a question for society to ask itself.
And this brings to mind the case of the son who, and I don't know what code of football his father was a coach for, but he had taken ice murdered his father. Mm. Now, I actually don't know what the outcome of that particular case was.
Oh, it was down in South Australia, I think. So, it wouldn't, more than likely wouldn't be relevant up here anyway, because the laws are different.
Different, yeah.
So...
Just it's that idea of if someone takes a particularly an illegal product and commits a crime under the influence of that, they would have to have a, so what I'm hearing is they would have to have a long-standing mental health incompetence for that to be able to be a course that they were able to take.
Certainly, and yes, that is correct. And this opens, this part of the conversation opens up an entirely different dialogue around mental health issues and how society deals with them and responds to them and addresses them. And that's an entire program in itself, isn't it?
Well, we'll be getting you back for sure.
We've got the calendar marked already. What, can you tell us what the difference is between being incompetent to stand trial or incompetent to be held responsible for your actions and diminished responsibility? What's the difference there?
Diminished responsibility is a defence to the the action that you're going on trial for. So this is the question about unfitness for trial is a threshold question. So you're charged with an offence, and the threshold question is, are you fit to proceed through the criminal justice process to have that charge put to you and you respond to that charge?
Mm-hmm.
Or are you so unfit that you need to go through the mental health processes? Now, if you're so unfit as you need to go through the mental health processes, you're not found guilty of any crime. You are subject to the circumstances, invariably placed in a secure psychiatric facility for treatment until you are healthy, if you can ever get healthy.
Yeah.
Okay. So with when you're charged with an offence and then you're determined to be fit for trial, and then that becomes part of your defence in terms of reducing the impact that it might otherwise have on any accountability that you have for that offence.
So could you be found unfit to stand trial and then 10 years down the track you're better and then they say, right, now we're going to hit you for the original offence?
No, you can't. No.
So once you've been found unfit, that's it, that charge is wiped and you can never be answered for it?
Well, it's not so much wiped. It's a fork in the road. You go down the mental health treatment path.
Right.
And it's not a holiday at a luxury resort.
No.
We're talking about a secure psychiatric facility.
Yes.
Where you are being treated medically for your condition, and for many of these people, they do not recover from their conditions. And for example, with respect to the lady, the Thaiday matter. even if you do recover, imagine what it is to realise the enormity of what it is that you have done.
Yeah, no, you'd be trapped in that prison
forever.
I'm not
sure that I could cope with that.
No.
No.
In fact, I know that I couldn't. And I know that most people couldn't. So it's not a get-out-of-jail-free card. These people are so severely mentally ill that they need significant, intensive psychiatric treatment to even just manage on a day-to-day basis.
And
it's a different question.
Is the question you're asked at that preliminary point, is it this person is not fit to stand trial and can't assist in their own defence, or is it this person is not guilty of a crime because they are so mentally ill that they had no idea that what they were doing was wrong?
That's
is it
correct.
One
they're,
or both?
They're not guilty. They're not guilty of a crime.
Okay.
Because they are so mentally incapable of even comprehending what it is that they've done.
Okay.
Okay. Well, Christine, that's been a fascinating talk. Is there anything you particularly wanted to add? I know that you've got an appointment tonight.
I could talk about these kind of issues forever and a day because I don't know whether you picked up. I'm a little passionate about.
little
You're
bit.
Subtle, but
it's snuck through.
It's snuck through. What seek help, people, and also look after your neighbours. You know, one of the sad tragedies of the Thiday matter was. There were some indicators, and as a society, we all have to take responsibility for what happens and how we personally respond. You know, if the behaviour you're prepared to accept is the behaviour you walk past,
yes.
then where do we stand if then later we're pointing fingers?
Yeah, and I think that's a very important question for everyone to reflect on, is really what part do we as a society actually play in these matters?
All right. Well, Christine, thank you.
Take care of each other.
Yeah.
Exactly.
If only. If only. All right, Christine, thank you very much for joining us tonight. Absolute pleasure. And we will have you back. I can promise you or threaten you, whichever you prefer.
Well, thank you. And thank you for allowing me to get on my soapbox about all these issues. Like I said, I'm fairly passionate about this and fairly passionate about advocating for, the issues that solicitors deal with on a daily basis. So I'm more than happy to help out.
That pro bono number of hours was extraordinary, and this is the idea of this show, is to talk about things that struggle to get out there in the public arena sometimes. So
well, thank you folks for doing a fantastic job in ensuring that happens. You're to be congratulated.
Okay, thanks, mate. Catch you later.
Thank you.
Bye
thank
now
you.